Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Federal Reserve did it again today, cut its main short-term interest rate half a point. That makes it two cuts in 8 days, not that anybody didn't know it was coming. But if you read between the lines, it's entirely possible the Fed knows something that we don't. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, January 30th. Great to have you with us. Interest rate announcements from the Federal Open Market Committee usually work a little something like this. Everybody gloms onto the headline number right away, whether it's a move down or a rate hike. Then they take a minute, a deep breath, and read the statement that goes along with the number. That's what happened today, and it turned what had been a fairly positive reaction to today's announcement squarely on its head. The headline number, of course, was a half-point cut in the federal funds rate, right about what everybody had been expecting. But then Mr. Bernanke and his colleagues took away the punch bowl. The statement had words like deepening of the housing contraction, financial markets under considerable stress, and downside risks to growth. In a way, you couldn't blame them for laying it all out on the line, because earlier this morning we got the number for fourth quarter gross domestic product. Marketplace's Bob Moon takes it from there.
A reading of just 0.6% annual growth may sound dismal, but Commerce Bank chief economist Joel Naroff argues the slowing pace was mainly a reflection of the housing market and businesses adjusting their inventories. Otherwise, he says, households and businesses continue to spend. He says that's keeping monetary policymakers guessing and probably crossing their fingers as they cut rates again today.
The Fed is worried about going too far, too fast in an economy that could pick up steam by the middle of the year and generate more inflation. So the Fed's in a very, very difficult position right now.
But before getting lost in the fairy tale world of Goldilocks, carefully trying to turn up the heat just right, some stock market strategists say the Fed has to focus on first things first. George Yarod at Yarod Investment Research.
We're never going to have a perfect scenario. They have to do the real balancing act. And I think right now the more pressing problem is the actual R word, is recession. And I think they want to delicately move the economy forward away from that. And then I think that any potential threat of inflation can then be addressed after that.
Today's statement says the Fed committee expects inflation to moderate in coming quarters, but also that it will be necessary to continue to monitor inflation developments carefully. Economist Joel Naroff says with any luck, the Fed won't have to worry about the dreaded combination of weak growth and inflation known as stagflation.
Really, the inflationary pressures tend to ebb as the economy slows. If indeed the economy does slow, I think the inflationary pressures that are out there will not be as great as they had been.
That's just one possible happy ending that's yet to be written. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
All right, now that we've covered the federal funds rate, let me trot out another one for you. It's a beast called the London Interbank Offering Rate, LIBOR, for those in the know. It's the rate at which banks lend to each other, but not just banks in London. Institutions all over the world use it, usually to help set interest rates on big corporate loans. That's fine when rates are heading up, but when the federal funds rate falls, like it is now, LIBOR falls too, which means banks could lose money if they're not careful. The last thing the economy needs now is more loans gone bad, so smart lenders are building in some insurance, as Ashley Milne-Tite reports from New York.
When companies apply to a big bank for a large loan, the bank goes out and recruits smaller investors to share the burden. The bank and the investors set the interest rate, a certain percentage on top of the LIBOR rate. That way, when LIBOR rises, the interest rate on the loan floats up. Ed Ribaudo is managing director of GE Capital Markets. He says now that interest rates are falling, investors are watching the return on their investments get squeezed.
So they've introduced the concept of a floor to prevent it from further eroding the return that they're guaranteeing to their underlying investor.
The LIBOR floor guarantees investors will be paid a certain amount of interest no matter how much the Federal Reserve cuts rates. Mike Hatley is president of Westgate Horizons Advisors. He says investors are worried about the weakening economy and the possibility that more loans will default.
And so with that sort of a backdrop, the arrangers of loans need to look for ways to make their loans more attractive to investors, and putting a LIBOR floor is one way to make the loan more attractive.
That helps lenders, but it flies in the face of what the Fed is trying to do. Ben Bernanke is cutting rates because he wants to make it easier for companies to borrow. But if the company gets a loan with a built-in LIBOR floor, it could find itself paying a high rate of interest no matter how many cuts the Fed makes. Steve Miller is a director at Standard & Poor's. He says so far only a few companies have been affected by this, and the ripple effects shouldn't spread far.
It wouldn't be some, you know, wide-ranging effect across the economy, but it does make it more expensive for borrowers that are facing liquidity challenges today to get amenable financing terms.
Miller says the riskier the company is, the more likely their investors are to insist on a LIBOR floor and a guaranteed payback rate. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
It's time now for the on the one hand, on the other hand part of today's economic news. The Fed said in its statement it sees softening in the labor market, and last month's employment report was underwhelming. But when we get the most recent numbers Friday morning, there might be a happier surprise. The data processing firm ADP, they handle payrolls for a good chunk of corporate America. They said today they're expecting a sharp rise in the number of jobs the economy added in January. Two more politicians joined the ranks of the jobless today. On the Republican side, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani is throwing his support behind Senator John McCain. And John Edwards called it quits in an announcement this afternoon. There is no word yet on whether Edwards will endorse one of his rivals. But that's not stopping anybody. Campaigns on both sides are going after the fresh pool of newly available donors. Jeremy Hobson has more.
Never have so many states participated in Super Tuesday, which means money matters like never before. More than 20 states, with some of the most expensive media markets in the country, will have their say next week. Evan Tracy heads the Campaign Media Analysis Group. He says the campaigns are desperately wooing the now unaffiliated donors.
The sooner they get there, the better for the candidates that are remaining in this race. Because I think literally what you're going to see over the next 7 days, these candidates are going to be adding to the media buys that they have on almost an hour-by-hour, day-by-day, based on what their daily fundraising tallies are.
Steve Weissman of the Campaign Finance Institute says for the campaigns left standing, it's all about attracting the bundlers, the super fundraisers who rally dozens of donors to give the maximum amount.
If someone has endorsed, like Giuliani with McCain, I would expect Giuliani would try to swing his bundlers behind McCain. Where they've not endorsed, like with Edwards, I think that the campaigns will be going after them.
The bundlers for John Edwards come largely from law firms. Even before Edwards withdrew, Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman reportedly slipped off to a reception in Puerto Rico to court lawyers at an annual conference. Barack Obama's finance director was there, too. But Colby College professor Anthony Corrado says it would be foolish to predict which candidate lawyers and other big donors will flock to now.
Many of these large donors will probably wait until Super Tuesday so they have a clearer picture of who the winner might be.
The campaigns aren't waiting. Already the front pages of both the Clinton and Obama websites have become tributes to John and Elizabeth Edwards. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
You know, the Fed might as well have kept its powder dry for all the effect it had on the stock market today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The southeastern part of the country is still stuck in its record drought. So to help conserve what they do have, environmental officials in Georgia have put limits on most outdoor water uses. That means come summertime, it might be tough to find a place to take a nice refreshing swim. Hot and sweaty constituents are angry constituents, so the legislature is trying to find a way around those bans to help bathers and businesses alike. Latif Munjin is a reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Now, there is already a ban on outdoor water use in a lot of North Georgia, right?
Yes, there is. There's a ban on outdoor watering with limited exemptions in North Georgia.
Some of those exemptions are golf courses and the like, but now outdoor pools have come into question?
Yes, they have. Even though we're in the winter now, because you cannot add water to outdoor pools, in effect render the outdoor pools useless during the summer.
So what we have here is the environmental commissioner of the state of Georgia looking to shut down some of these outdoor pools. But at the same time, the business community and lobbying groups are coming in and saying, wait a minute, this is a big industry and you're really going to hurt some companies and some businesses here.
Exactly. There's been some lobbying behind the scenes because, of course, businesses that will be affected by this, they've got some legislators interested in their plight. And it's not only the businesses, there's also a large number of swim leagues that would not be able to do their activities if the pools are banned.
Governor Perdue, though, has been very public about his concern over the water situation. I mean,
exactly.
He's met with other governors. They've been in Washington. He's not been shy about saying it's a big, big problem.
It is, but basically, you know, we need the water for drinking, and that's the ultimate use. So, you know, the governor has to weigh all these things.
This ban affects not only large public municipal pools and not only hotel pools, but does it also affect the outdoor pools that people have in their backyards?
Exactly, it does.
Which then gets to the whole pool guy problem, where people who maintain and fix these pools run out of a livelihood.
Exactly, and a lot of these businesses are mom-and-pops organizations. You know, in my reporting, I called a lot to see how they were affected. It's a death toll for them.
And so where does this end, do you think? If the legislatures give themselves the power, and if the governor agrees to it, what are we going to see? Are we going to see these businesses survive, or are we going to see pools being closed down?
It's going to be a tough fight. Ultimately, the decision is in the hands of our governor. If we get rain, you know, it'll render these decisions moot. We would have to have 4 consecutive months of rain to be able to get out of this drought. So, you know, the governor can have 4 months from now to make this decision. I would say if the bill is passed, the pools will open for the summer, and they'll put the pools within these exemptions.
Because it's hot in Georgia in the summertime.
Exactly. It's very hot here.
Latif Munjin at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Latif, thanks a lot for your time.
I really appreciate it.
Allstate Insurance is still paying out for last fall's California wildfires. The biggest home insurer in the country announced a 37% drop in quarterly profits, largely because of losses due to those fires. Commentator and former National Park Service Director Roger Kennedy says unless governments and taxpayers change their ways, we're going to keep hearing the same old story.
The land rush into fire danger continues, still subsidized by federal taxpayers. Construction crews continue to race against fire crews, and each time fire returns, brave young people are put at risk of their lives, rescuing homeowners encouraged to build and buy where fire will surely strike. It's as if we kept sending rescue squads out into busy freeways to rescue baby carriages left there by people not aware of the danger. Fire recurs, and each year after it does, we spend an average of nearly $2 billion of our taxpayer money on everything from firefighting to infrastructure rebuilding, after having committed even more to create the incentives to build in harm's way. Who's to blame? We make loans and grants to developers in dangerous places, pick up the tab for federal mortgage insurance on buildings set in fire traps, then pay for the roads into those fire traps and for much of their electric power and water. We also pay for most of the satellites that provide the pictures that tell reinsurers which locations are most likely to burn, but taxpayers don't have access to that information. This system is murderous, expensive, and wrong. Now that firefighters are asking for a moral and taxpayers' revolt before global warming and drying make matters worse. Let's cut financial assistance and let each individual take what risk he or she understands, unsubsidized and properly warned. And while we're at it, let's stop building the roads to disaster and end guaranteed mortgages on houses built in fire traps. They're really subprime from a firefighter's point of view. By letting the free market do its work without the huge subsidies from the federal treasury, we can slow the land rush to a manageable trickle.
Roger Kennedy is a former director of the National Park Service. His book is called Wildfire and Americans. Send us your thoughts on what Mr. Kennedy had to say or anything else you hear on the program. Marketplace.org is the website. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, some earth-shaking, groundbreaking solutions to global warming.
The economics of geoengineering, when I began to look into them, were simply astonishing.
But first, let's do the numbers. That half-point rate cut just didn't do it today. The Dow Industrials closed down 0.3%, 37 points to end the day at 12,442. The Nasdaq fell 0.3%, 9 points, finished at 2,349. The S&P 500 lost 0.4%, 6 points, closed at 1,355. Reports of massive job cuts at Yahoo ravaged the Internet's number two search engine. Its stock tumbled almost 8.5% today. Boeing cruised 2.3% higher on stronger-than-expected fourth-quarter earnings. Business was brisk for the number two commercial jet maker, even with those delays for the 787 Dreamliner. Merck coughed up 2.75% after it posted a huge fourth quarter loss. Costs for Vioxx settlements hit the pharmaceutical giant pretty hard. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. And by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to Marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for December. It's the last debate before Super Tuesday. Democratic presidential hopefuls get down to business at the Kodak Theater in Los Angeles. And the Senate Special Aging Committee discusses challenges facing elderly voters in this year's election. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The campaign for the Republican presidential nomination comes to Southern California today. The remaining hopefuls will debate each other this evening at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. There will be four men on the stage, but most of the attention will be focused on Mitt Romney and John McCain. Each is trying to convince voters he's the best choice in difficult economic times. To find out how Senator McCain might do that, we've got his senior economic advisor, Douglas Holtz-Aiken, with us. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
What's the senator's thoughts on the stimulus package that's bouncing its way through Congress?
Well, the senator, I guess, is disappointed that the political environment at the moment has taken off the table any attempt at permanent measures. He's had proposals for permanent reductions in the corporate income tax rate, for first-year business expensing of all equipment investment. Those kinds of permanent measures might be quite valuable, but they don't look to be part of the debate in Congress.
Let's be clear, though, that the matter at hand is the short-term package, not a long-term package. What is the senator proposing for the short term?
The senator is going to support packages that are consistent with the president's initiative for the short term. He, as I said, has made proposals that would be permanent proposals, but it's important to recognize that if those are policies which are desirable in the long run, they would also have short-term benefit. Powerful business investment, money in the hands of middle-class families. You can do things which are both beneficial in the short run and help you over the long term.
On that longer-term economic plan, a centerpiece of his proposal is to make President Bush's tax cuts permanent. He voted against those tax cuts twice. How is he now for them?
He is a foot soldier in the Reagan Revolution. He saw President Reagan cut taxes within the context of budget discipline and controls on spending. Senator McCain did not see that same discipline accompanying the 2001-2003 tax cuts and did not support them as a result. I think the evidence is in on what the failure to control spending has wrought in Washington. And it is imperative in the future that the Bush tax cuts be made permanent, but that they be accompanied by controls on spending so as not to overly burden the American economy with a government that has grown too large.
John McCain staked a good part of his early campaign on the national security threat to this country. How does he now transition from the national security threat to a fading economy and keep paying for the national security infrastructure in this country?
Having a strong military is not the same thing as saying, well, you write a blank check to the Defense Department. We've seen that kind of an approach. It doesn't work. We need to make sure that we're only buying those systems which will enhance our capability. So we can control the cost within the Defense Department to a great extent by being smart about what's bought, by being smart about how it's bought, and as a result, be able to better finance those boots on the ground, the Army and Marines necessary for the operations in which we're engaged.
Can't talk to the senior economic policy advisor to John McCain without asking him about the quote that's been making the rounds, where he says, in essence, I don't really know as much as I should about economics, but hey, I've got Alan Greenspan's book. How is he now the guy to get us through a recession?
He can be self-deprecating, and his self-deprecation has now been floated around every possible outlet to be held against him. But that's the nature of negative campaigning. He understands the power of the American economy. He will make the decisions necessary to power us to greater prosperity in the future.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken is a senior economic policy advisor to John McCain. Mr. Holtz-Aiken, thanks a lot for your time.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Our interviews with campaign economic advisors continue tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report and online at marketplace.org. While you're there, let us know which, if any, of the candidates and their platforms sound good to you. Just click on Election 2008. We've been doing some what-ifing around the issue of climate change this week. What if we can't get greenhouse gases under control? Plan B, the series we're wrapping up today, has explored some of the ways we're adapting, just in case our best ideas to stop global warming aren't good enough. Some of those ideas sound pretty far out, like generating a giant cloud out in space to block the rays of the sun, or launching what amounts to a really big umbrella. Nate DeMeo reports the proposals are almost too risky to try and too risky not to.
Ken Caldera wasn't having any of it. A few years ago, the Stanford climate scientist was at a big conference, and he sat and listened while prominent colleagues said we could stop global warming by blocking the sun with a gigantic space shade.
These ideas basically seemed kind of crazy to me at the time, and we were saying, well, this will never work.
So he set out to prove that it wouldn't, but then something went wrong.
Each time we tried to show why this was such a bad idea, the results of our studies indicated that it would basically work.
Not perfectly, but the assumption held up. You could cool down the Earth by blocking some sunlight. Since the 60s, people way out in the fringes have been proposing ways to do it. They call it geoengineering. Most of the ideas sound like they come straight out of science fiction, things like reflecting the sun with millions of mirrored satellites. But there's one idea that's beginning to gain traction among respected scientists, and it comes straight from Mother Earth. 16 years ago, Mount Pinatubo erupted in the Philippines, killing hundreds and blanketing much of the surrounding area in ash and debris. But some of those particles never touched ground. Instead, they swirled in the upper atmosphere for more than 2 years. Those particles diffused heat from the sun, and the Earth cooled down. Now, with projections about climate change worsening, people are starting to ask very seriously if a simulated volcanic eruption should be Plan B for reversing global warming.
The economics of geoengineering, when I began to look into them, were simply astonishing.
Scott Barrett spent years trying to figure out ways to get the world to work together to reduce emissions and stop climate change. But the Johns Hopkins economist came to a depressing conclusion. Human society, with its 200-odd sovereign states, its imperfect capitalism, and its convoluted trade regimes, wasn't going to get its act together to stop climate change. Among the many, many stumbling blocks, the potential price tag for all the steps you would need to take to reduce global emissions runs in the tens of trillions of dollars. But a simulated volcano?
Costs range, I've seen, from anywhere from $1 billion a year to up to maybe $50 billion a year. Now, that's a lot of money, but even $50 billion a year, that's only a month or so in Iraq. So it's actually doable, even for a single country.
But it could be dangerously doable.
Throwing particles in the stratosphere is one of the few things a politician can do quickly.
Ken Caldera says we should think of a simulated volcano as an emergency response. You know, in case of global warming, break glass. But he says he's still got some serious reservations.
Well, our model suggests that this could help. It also has the potential to really screw things up profoundly.
It's more like trying to fit a new, untested kind of engine on a 747 while it's completely full and you're flying across the Atlantic and you have to get it right the first time.
Raymond Pierre Humbert studies planetary climates at the University of Chicago. Bottom line, bad things happen when you mess with the Earth's atmosphere. For one thing, the benefits of a cool-down world wouldn't be evenly distributed.
So if there's a conflict between people in Texas who would like to geoengineer their climate so people aren't dying in the summer, and people in India who would like to hold on to their monsoon rains, who gets to decide or adjudicate that?
Geoengineering is almost too easy to do.
Economist Scott Barrett says there's real danger in giving countries, and even corporations, the ability to put their fingers on the global thermostat. But for all the potential problems with geoengineering, Barrett says we do need to explore the possibilities. He's calling for an international agreement on experimentation. A few months ago, Ken Caldera wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. He called for 1% of climate change research funding to go to geoengineering. But he says he has to walk a fine line.
I do feel somewhat conflicted about it in that I know it will be used by some people as a reason to not reduce emissions.
But he says we can't keep our heads in the sand and pretend geoengineering doesn't exist. We already tried that with climate change. I'm Nate DeMeo for Marketplace.
You can hear all of the stories from our series Plan B on our website. It's marketplace.org. Plan B was a co-production with the Center for Investigative Reporting.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, if the economy is not already in a recession and nobody really knows for sure, it could be gas that tips the balance. The Civil Society Institute released a survey of consumer reactions to pump prices today. The group advocates for more fuel-efficient cars and trucks. Its survey shows that with gas at $4 a gallon, more than half of all Americans would reduce holiday travel and cut back on personal spending. Oil did slip just a little bit today, closed right around $91.50 a barrel. And we close right there. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 37 points, 0.3%. The Nasdaq dropped 9 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 dipped 6 points. That's 0.4%. Mark your calendars, March 18th for the next meeting of the Federal Reserve. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Mbornone, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, policing corruption, steering a country toward democracy. It's all just a day in the life of one Macedonian politician.
You know, very few people have opportunity as I have. So it's a unique chance, and you have opportunity to do something really big.
Another installment of our series, Working. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening
because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.